solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
There's a famous case here, which is very interesting, of the amnesiac patient in the United States named H.M., who was has written about by many psychologists. And he was undergoing some interesting experiments where he was being taught this sort of a motor skills exercise in a lab setting. And he was an amnesiac, so every day he would actually forget the next day that he was learning this thing. But he actually was making improvement in the thing itself. So it just sort of showed that, you know, skills operate in this different part of the brain than the knowledge we have about things. You know, he might have forgotten that he knew how to ride a bike, but he actually could still ride a bike, which is sort of a very odd thing, I think, and just speaks to, skills have this sort of automatic presence in our lives that many of us don't think much about these things, because once you know how to do something well, you stop thinking about it. We don't, if you go for a walk this afternoon, you're not going to look down at your feet and wonder if you're walking correctly or could I walk better? Or, you know, it's just, you've made that a fully automatic behavior. And if you actually did try to think about it, you'll make it worse. So,
welcome to the 76th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host Deepak Jayaraman, and this podcast is a labor of love for the long term, where I have conversations with leading practitioners, thinkers, authors, artists, sportsmen, and several other leading professionals to decode insights around leadership, transitions, and careers. When I'm not podcasting, I'm working with leaders as a trusted sounding board, helping them and their organizations play to their unique potential. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do visit playtopotential.com. That's PlayToPotential.com. Well, we have an exciting update to the podcast. Several listeners have told us that we should be sharing some of the nuggets from the archives, given we have 750 odd nuggets in the library and we continue to build on it. And we've started doing that for the last couple of weeks through WhatsApp, where we share a couple of nuggets a week, one in the middle of the week and one over the weekend. And if you wish to receive these, do note the number +91 85914 52129. Add that number to your contacts and just send us a one-word message stating interested, and we'll add you to the list. I repeat, the number is +91 85914 52129. My guest this time is Tom Vanderbilt, the author of the book Beginners. For many of us, the last time we learned a new skill was possibly during childhood. We live in an age which reveres expertise but possibly looks down on the beginner. Upon entering adulthood and middle age, we often begin to shy away from trying new things, instead preferring to stay nestled firmly in our comfort zones. The book Beginners asks the fundamental question: why are children the only ones allowed to experience the inherent fun of facing daily challenges? And could we benefit from embracing new skills, even if we are initially hopeless? Inspired by his young daughter's insatiable need to know how to do almost everything, and stymied by his own rut of mid-career competence, Tom Vanderbilt begins a year of learning purely for the sake of learning. He tackles 5 main skills, and of course picks up a few more along the way, choosing them for their difficulty to master and their distinct lack of career marketability. So he picks chess, singing, surfing, drawing, and juggling. Personally, I learned juggling for a couple of years about 20 odd years back when I was in London, and continue to be passionate about learning new tricks. And truth be told, that was what drew me into reading the book and having the conversation with Tom. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Tom Vanderbilt about being a beginner.
Tom, excited to have you at the Play to Potential podcast. Thank you so much for making the time.
My pleasure. Great to be here. Thank you.
And in this series, we talk to people about their journeys and about their insights on specific themes. I'd love to dive into your recent book, Beginners. But before that, I'm curious about your journey over the last 20-odd years, Tom, specifically your arc of curiosity. You wrote about sneakers in 98. You wrote about Atomic America, which was around the architecture of the Cold War in 2002. Then you wrote about a book on traffic, why we drive the way we do, in 2008. Then you moved to writing about taste. And now you've written a book on being an adult beginner. So walk us through, connect these dots for us.
Well, I wish the dots were a bit more closely linked than they actually are. But, I'm a person, I think, with a chronically short attention span. I thought headed for graduate school, and I determined that I wasn't sure spending X number of years in political science was actually what I wanted to do. So I sort of moved away from that and worked on, something else that was working better for me and that attention span I alluded to, which was writing. So it is a wayward path you've laid out. And I think in regards to my new book, Beginners, I think journalists are actually consummate beginners in a sense, because, we're always sort of parachuting into new worlds that we might not know that much about, and having to very quickly gain a sense of sort of who the key players are, what the stakes are, what are the good sources of information, the bad sources of information. And then, sort of doing that for a few weeks, inhabiting this world, which may be, sort of robotics 1 month, and then I'm just making something up, food science the next month, and then sort of moving on from there, and then restarting every month. So, it creates a strong sense of, let's say, intellectual humility, I think, which is this notion that I myself, don't feel like I possess a great amount of knowledge about any one thing, but I use that sort of that insecurity or that fear to, that attracts me to people who do know what they're talking about, and I sort of try to get the stories from them. But I think, what I do have is just a willingness to listen, an openness to new ideas, a penchant for keeping my eyes open. And I think that is because I think, there are many obvious stories that are out there in the world, in terms of journalism. I mean, anything to do in the United States with politics over the last 4 years has been, those are very obvious stories. They're out in front of us. But to my mind, there's a lot of, very interesting stories that are sort of hidden right in front of us in broad daylight. And just to give one example of a story that springs to mind that was something I was sort of fond of, was I wrote a story about the shipping pallet and how it was sort of the under-heralded superhero of the global economy. And these are these things, these wooden, sort of platforms that we ship goods on. And it's sort of a simple device that really helped move into containerized shipping. And, once you start to look for these things, you see them everywhere. And I looked into this, and it's something that the average person would not think anything about, nor probably care anything about, until you find a way to try to convince them that it actually is interesting. So I think that's, just to sum up, that's sort of been a lot of my work, is it's looking for those sort of interesting things that are hidden in plain sight and then trying to tell people why they should care.
Very interesting. And even there, how much of it is just purely driven by your curiosity, Tom? And how much is it driven by, would there be an appetite or market for this kind of a story? I'm just curious. As a journalist, do you think about the latter?
Very good question. I mean, I think generally it's my curiosity, which often is tied to what the market wants. Although it's an inexact science, one never is fully sure. I will say with that pallet story, it was actually rejected by a few publications, and then published by an online magazine called Slate, and it became an incredibly popular piece, and got quite a bit of feedback on that. So in some cases, you're never quite sure what will catch the public's fancy. But it is a very intuitive business. It's not like you're really doing market research about what readers want. You're just going with your gut instinct of what might make a good story. And that can also go the wrong way. And you write something that turns out people aren't that interested in.
Got it. And just as you look at your journey as a journalist and a writer over the years, Tom, how have you thought about staying relevant? And what are some of the choices you've made in the context? You know, in a lot of ways, people's attention span, they're just much, much more sort of hitting at people, demanding their attention. How have you stayed relevant amidst this whole changing dynamic in the content space?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I guess one of the challenges is simply keeping up, staying on top of things, moving with the changing times. And, you know, journalism has had a number of changes where maybe 20 years ago, I was simply asked to write a piece for a magazine, and then we might get some letters the next month in the magazine. I mean, now we're, you know, people are asked to produce a podcast, to take their own photography, you know, as technology has changed. And there's been more sort of a, and this is an interesting case where amateurism has kind of combined with professionalism, and you know, the advent of something like the iPhone. I've actually had publications print my photographs shot on an iPhone X, which is, you know, it's sort of amazing given that, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, this was only the job of a professional photographer, that's where you got the images from. So, you know, just sort of staying nimble in that regard certainly helps. And I just think that I've always been an infovore, tried to, you know, just devour whatever information was available. And going back a number of decades, this was not as easy as a thing as it is now. And I can remember even in college having a subscription, for example, to a publication that was The Guardian Weekly, Le Monde, and The Washington Post combined in an airmail edition. And this was sent to you weekly, and it was, you know, it wasn't particularly cheap, but it just goes to show, you know, information was not as widely available then. So, you know, I went out of my way to sort of look for other perspectives that I wasn't getting at home or in my local sources. So, of course, now we have, as you say, with the attention economy, the opposite problem. There's more information than we could ever digest, and it becomes now sort of a sifting thing, you know, how to find what is really important, what is undervalued, overvalued. But relevance, yeah, and at the end of the day, I think just having that internal compass of what you think, again, makes a good story, what readers might like, and then just trying to produce quality work is all I can really say to that.
I guess maybe just sticking with it before we dive into the book, Tom, you know, if you really looked at somebody who's embarking on a career in writing today versus someone like you who started this journey maybe a couple of decades back, are there any elements that have changed in terms of what it takes to stand out and succeed today versus maybe a couple of decades back?
Yeah, good question. I mean, the market has obviously changed tremendously, and it's there are, yeah, it's not something I've thought rigorously about. I'm sorry, but I think again, finding ways to generate attention without being gimmicky. I do think in the end, quality will win out. But I mean, writing from the day I began was just, it's just one of those careers where you have to do the legwork, you have to do the work that is not paid, you have to sort of do the grunt work, to put it that way, you know, and build up sort of a reputation slowly. There are those people that sort of erupt onto the stage immediately, but it's a job that a lot of people would like to do, and thus it becomes, there's sort of the pay scale can be pushed down because of that, due to the law of supply and demand. So it's a Darwinian profession, let's say, but yeah.
And the reason I ask,
sorry, go ahead.
Now the reason I ask is that I was reading a sports magazine some time back, which spoke about the greatest athlete ever, the greatest sports person ever, and it sort of drew a comparison between Michael Phelps and Usain Bolt. Mm-hmm. And the crux of the argument was, anybody with two legs can run, but to swim you need a swimming pool. So, you know, by definition, someone like an Usain Bolt is competing with, you know, 7 billion people or whatever, while Michael Phelps is competing with, you know, a small fraction. You know, that might be an oversimplification of the argument, but where I was coming at was writing is something that all of us are taught. So in a way, everybody, you know, can, like you said, can click a photo on an iPhone, can write a piece on a, on, you know, on a certain day. So that just makes it interesting in just in terms of supply. So I was curious how that impacts people who want to do writing as a career.
Yes, and there are certainly, you know, venues such as places like Medium, for example, the website publication that, you know, you will find a lot of people submitting articles there that are not quote unquote professional writers, and that's just one of the many venues or blogs or, I mean, so it's been completely democratized in that regard where you don't need traditional gatekeepers of an editor or a publisher, and you can sort of go to market yourself. But yeah, I mean, for much of us in the existing traditional industry, it's still a question of, you know, it's the same as in any business. People come to me because they like what I like what I'm saying, or they know that I'll produce something that that they can. They won't have, it won't cause them that much work on their side. You know, that I can produce a quality product. I mean, it's these personal relationships that, because often this is deadline driven work that, you know, you need something brought to you that is in good shape. But as you say, I mean, it is a funny thing where thinking of beginners, writing might be something that people dabble in on the side as a sort of hobby, and hobbies have this strange existence in our lives. And there's a sociologist who described it in a funny way. He said, you know, hobbies turn work into leisure and leisure into work. And, you know, some of us fall on one or the other side of that, but, you know, there often comes a tipping point where you're doing something as a hobby, and then it becomes, you decide to sort of commodify it, or vice versa, you've taken on something in your spare time that you've put such energy into. It's almost as much as a job, but perhaps you're not being compensated. It just kind of shows this dual nature we have in with our interests, and you know, sometimes we might not find that reward or gratification in our jobs, so we might look for something on the side, call it a pursuit or a hobby. But and sometimes people, you know, entrepreneurs have been born because, you know, something they were doing just as for pleasure actually clicked in some way. And but we can
got it.
Talk about that later.
Lovely. Let's segue into the book Beginners, Tom. You know, before we get into the specifics of the book, give us a sense of how this whole thing came about. You went around learning 5 totally new skills: singing, surfing, drawing, juggling, and making a ring. Give us a sense of the origin of this whole experiment, shall we say.
Sure. I was basically in my mid-40s and had a daughter with my wife, obviously. But I was sort of, we were both later parents, and this whole experience was very, it sort of upset our lives. We had a lot of time and experience in not being parents, and suddenly we were parents. And so our own learning curve was accelerating greatly, and we were suddenly, you know, there's a lot you can sort of try to read up on ahead of time about how to be a parent, but a lot of it is just learning by the seat of the pants. So, but as part of this process, I then, you know, a parent then is entrusted to try to teach their child all these things, and children are such natural, eager learners. One day I was with my daughter in a library, and we were playing a game of checkers, and she saw a chessboard nearby. She's about 4 years old, and she said, "Can we play a game of chess?" And I said, "You know, I would love to, but I actually don't know how to play." And this was, you know, an incredibly awkward thing to admit to your child, because you want to be the picture of authority and competence. But I'd probably learned the basic rules of chess a long time ago, but it had never stuck. I'd forgotten it. So I quickly tried to learn the game online, and I got to a certain point where I was, you know, sort of had gotten the basic rules down, but it's such a complex game that obviously, you know, after 5 moves, the cliche is that there, you know, there are more possible moves than there are atoms in the universe. It's an infinitely complex game. So I felt a little bit over my head. I decided to hire a coach to give her lessons. And then the coach came to the house, and I suddenly had this realization, why should I pay this person to teach my daughter this thing that I would also like to learn? And, you know, so rather than hide out in the other room, why don't I simply join the lesson? And he thought, well, this is a bit unorthodox. You have a 4-year-old beginner and a 46-year-old beginner, whatever I was. But, you know, I was so struck by the experience that, number one, it was a very exciting and sort of gratifying thing to be engaging in this learning process with my daughter. And then the second thing, though, I sort of holding up the mirror to myself, I realized I was constantly telling her how important it was to learn as many things as possible and to just be open-minded and don't worry so much about, at your age, about whether you're actually good or how good you get. Just do it for the pleasure of it. And sort of looking at myself, I realized, you know, I'm giving this advice, but what was the last new sort of pursuit or skill I had actually tried to take up? So I was not being a particularly good role model, and that was just, you know, sort of an internal alarm went off that I felt this was a part of my character, personality, psyche that I was neglecting. I had focused on so much on a job that I really enjoyed, but to the exclusion of any other types of pleasures or even growth that might be out there via this thing that we might call hobbies or pursuits or skills or passions, or, you know, there's a variety of ways. So that was the basic genesis.
Got it. And you want to talk a little bit about how you picked these five different things, Tom, of the various choices?
Sure. I mean, at first I thought, you know, well, maybe I should do these things that I keep hearing about that people should learn, like coding. And I thought, well, you know, I like computers. Coding is interesting to me, but that felt a little, you know, extrinsic to me, that I was sort of taking this lead from other people about what I should learn. And I thought, you know, what are the things that I've actually, the sort of the secret list in my head of things I might have wanted to learn at some point. So I think this was an important part of the process for me, because this wasn't mandatory training for a job or something like that, or I wasn't, you know, there was no reason other than my own interest and pleasure to do these things, that I needed them to have sort of an element of enjoyment to them as much as other things, because, you know, that is an essential part of providing, I think, the necessary motivation to keep at these things, which may end up being frustrating to you or time consuming. So I just had this sort of internal list I drew up, and the things were basically singing, surfing, drawing, juggling. And then I wanted a making component, making a thing, because I felt, like a lot of people do, I think, in our sort of information age, that I was a little bit divorced from working with my hands in any measurable way, that I was simply on a computer all day pushing electrons around. And I thought it would be interesting to plunge in. So the thing I decided, though, was I had actually, in the process of learning to surf, I had lost 2 wedding rings because of the cold water, and my finger had shrunk and the ring had fallen off into the depths of the ocean. So I needed a wedding ring. I thought, well, perhaps I could make that ring. That would be the thing I would make. And so it was just a little kind of curriculum I had come up with on my own in a liberal arts fashion. I thought I'd covered a number of different bases, sort of a physical activity, an artistic activity, a pure sort of motor skills activity. And the only other criteria were, you know, that there were things I could learn close to my home in New York City at the time. I didn't have to travel to do, or nothing too exotic, and skills that wouldn't be too all consuming. Obviously, you know, like becoming a commercial airline pilot or something like that. That's a different sort of prospect. So, but on the flip side, though, I wanted them to be substantial skills, not the sort of skills that one might go to YouTube for over the course of a weekend to, you know, learn how to briefly fix a plumbing issue in one's home, or how to do something in the kitchen the right way. I mean, and there's nothing, those are, you know, that form of micro mastery, as it's been called, is very human thing to do. And we all do it a lot, I think. But those didn't have the narratives I was looking for, or the challenge, or the sort of lifelong aspect, where I think the things I ended up choosing we're all fairly open-ended. I could still be trying to improve singing 10 years from now and not be at the top of my game. So perhaps a bit too ambitious.
And did you give yourself a certain period of time? At the outset, did you say you would learn for X period of time, or was it reasonably open-ended when you kicked off this journey?
I thought maybe a year, but I think that was just, I was telling the publisher that to be convenient. Of course, what happened is I really sort of became enamored with the things I was doing. But I didn't really want to rush anything. And there are certainly ways you could sort of rush it more, but I really wanted to sort of savor the learning process at each stage, even the failures. And of course I was trying to do all these things at the same time. So, which often meant I was simply feeling guilty for neglecting one thing at the cost of another. But I felt I would know when I was ready to sort of start writing about it. So there was a strange period of research where I was just doing all of these things, which is different from a usual book project for me, but also talking to people along the way that I met and coaches as well. So,
got it. And at the outset, Tom, you say it's a why to do book and less of a how to do book. And you also, I like the distinction you make between two types of knowledge, right? Declarative knowledge and procedural knowledge. Do you want to shine the light on the distinction here?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I said why to do rather than how to do, because I reading this book will not necessarily, you know, make you a better singer, surfer, drawer, juggler, or maker of things. But I what I really wanted to do is to get people past the initial hurdle that many of us feel as adults in simply trying something new because of this internal self-talk that, you know, it's not important to our job. We're too old. I might be bad at that thing in front of other people. Why would I want to invite that into my life? So that was sort of the motivation there. And you mentioned procedural and declarative knowledge. And these are interesting things because they sort of speak to the role of skills in our lives and skill learning. And now procedural learning is knowing how to do something. And declarative is knowing about something, knowing the knowledge that you know how to do something. There's a famous case here, which is very interesting, of the amnesiac patient in the United States named H.M., who was has written about by many psychologists. And he was undergoing some interesting experiments where he was being taught this sort of a motor skills exercise in a lab setting. And he was an amnesiac, so every day he would actually forget the next day that he was learning this thing, but he actually was making improvement in the thing itself. So it just sort of showed that, you know, skills operate in this different part of the brain than the knowledge we have about things. You know, he might have forgotten that he knew how to ride a bike, but he actually could still ride a bike, which is sort of a very odd thing, I think, and just speaks to, you know, skills have this sort of automatic presence in our lives that many of us don't think much about these things, because once you know how to do something well, you stop thinking about it. We don't, you know, if you go for a walk this afternoon, you're not going to look down at your feet and wonder if you're walking correctly or could I walk better? Or, you know, it's just, you've made that a fully automatic behavior. And if you actually did try to think about it, you'll make it worse.
The Inner Game of Tennis, which I read some time back, which talks a little bit about, not letting your thinking coming in the way of playing.
Yeah, which is a hard lesson because we're, you know, very analytical as adults and used to trying to, and we tend to overthink things. And this is one element where being an adult beginner is a little bit more of a challenge, because children will sort of plunge into trying to learn an activity simply by sort of imbibing it and not really knowing what the rules are, often not having a lot of experience with other things like that. For example, you know, learning a language, kids just they do things like babble or they mimic and they constantly go back and forth with their parents. They're not thinking about grammatical structures. If I tried to learn a language today, I have this entire history of five decades of speaking English. So English, my brain is very well tuned for English. If I try to, you know, put another grammar form on top of that, it's going to be very difficult. There's this process of interference, as psychologists call it. So, you know, and then there's sort of a vicious cycle that happens here. Once I start struggling with that language, I'll be aware that I'm struggling with it. That will cause embarrassment, tension. I'll really start thinking about how I'm speaking, and then that just makes the whole thing go worse. Yeah. So Galway was right in that, you know, sometimes the key to effective skill learning is to stop thinking and often just try to put your body into this pure sort of autopilot mode. And I had a juggling instructor who used the instructions to be the robot, and the robot was just my hands sort of moving in this robotic fashion and not trying to think that how they were moving, but just to simply move them. And so it sounds, I don't know, sort of counterintuitive, I guess, or something, but it just to bring the point back home, it shows how these processes exist in different parts of our brain. And that even if you forgot that you knew how to do something, you could still actually do it. Speak to the old cliche about riding a bicycle is that you never forget how, and we really don't.
And you speak about the roles of fluid and crystallized intelligence in the way children and adults learn, Tom. Could you talk a little bit about what these two types of intelligences are and, you know, therefore, what does it mean in terms of how we think about learning as adults?
Sure. I mean, you know, fluid intelligence is the sort of, you know, rapid fire, quick, you know, sort of puzzle solving intelligence, you know, solving problems very quickly, spotting things. To use the game of chess as an example, my daughter was very good at spotting potential checkmates, you know, playing very well in blitz games, which are 5 minutes per player, because, you know, her brain was just operating very quickly. You know, crystallized intelligence refers more to these things that are built up over time, like wisdom and metacognition. And the way it sort of looks in the human brain is that the adult brain draws on sort of a wider area of the brain in cognition than the young brain does. And this comes at a certain cost. We have to work harder to achieve the same result, but it also gives us a certain larger sense of bandwidth. And in everyday life, this exhibits itself in things like, you know, wisdom. Or so in the game of chess, she would be good at those other things I mentioned, quick puzzle solving, things like that. But I would have an edge in, let's say, the slower. To think of Daniel, the psychologist Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. So fluid is the thinking fast, crystallized is the thinking slow. And there are many moments in the game of chess when you want to think slow. You might want to think about, you know, your strategy. You might want to think about, does this game remind you of another game you saw? Having the patience to. Another thing is, my daughter was always guilty of not doing in the beginning was, she would play her game as if she were playing by herself, basically never thinking what the opponent. Why the opponent was doing what they were doing. And this is something that as adults, you know, I think we have more of a sixth sense here of, you know, sort of looking out for things like that. You know, okay, he just moved his queen there. Why did he do that? That's sort of the, and it sort of breaks down that adults are sort of more oriented toward the crystallized wisdom and children, the fluid, although we, of course, both sets of people have both of those capacities, but.
Got it. And moving to a different theme, Tom, you talk about, you know, specifically your experience with biking, you know, where you say you tried it for a while and at some stage you stopped having fun and it started feeling like work, and you alluded to it at the beginning of this conversation. And you also link it to the way we think about identity, right? I'd love for you to talk about the link between some sort of a satisficing mindset and our approach to these pursuits on the side. Can you talk a little bit about specifically maybe relating to your journey with biking?
Sure. Yeah. When I was around 40, I started road cycling, which is a very common thing for middle-aged men to do. In fact, there's an acronym. The word is MAML, which stands for middle-aged man in Lycra, because you often see, because cycling is one of these lifetime sports that you can do without, you know, hurting your knees or things like this. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Exactly. So, I sort of got, plunged into this world. I became very excited and sort of intoxicated by it. And at first it was just sort of riding for pleasure, but then I met some people that were, a bit competitive, and I ended up joining an amateur racing team. And the way this is structured is you start out as a category 5 and then you work your way down to category 1. I mean, if you were amazing, you would go down to 1, but, it was all very good in the beginning, and I was investing large amounts of time, but it was satisfying, and I was gaining fitness and having new relationships and having interesting conversations, and it just getting out of the house and seeing nature and just nothing but good. But because of that sort of progressive nature of competition, where what happens if you do pretty well in a Cat 5 race is eventually you get sort of bumped up to Cat 4, and then you're back at the back of the pack again because you're in a harder zone of competition. So to me, this began to feel like, because this wasn't, again, it wasn't my job, but it was starting to feel like a job, and that there were benchmarks I was having to meet. I was having to wake up very early in the morning to go on these training rides. It felt just a little too, enforced dietary regimens. And at some point the pleasure aspect was being sacrificed for this drive to simply, get better and better. And this is something that it's a very natural thing, but there's a lot of talk out there about mastery and expert level performers and the Anders Ericsson's famous 10,000 hours rule of deliberate practice to achieve expert level perfection. But I was never under the illusion that I was going to, I was a 40-year-old. There was no path to professional cycling for me. So I started to wonder, why am I pushing myself so hard, for this thing that is meant to, at the end of the day, be something that's a safety valve for the other parts of my life, something that I'm choosing to spend my leisure time on this thing. So, other people, probably did not have this experience. They were happy to keep, sort of pushing on. But I also saw many people sort of fall by the wayside. And so I think, we tend to forget sometimes that a lot of this mastery talk we hear, is sort of oriented at professionals or expert level performers, not for people trying to get into something, particularly later on in life, who might be lucky to have 100 hours to devote to improvement, not 10,000. So I sort of, made a, sort of walked away, stepped back from cycling. And of course, a cynic might say, well, you were simply just weren't good enough. And I mean, there is that too. I mean, one does come up against the edges of one's performative quality, and some of this is genetic and some of it is training, but I didn't feel like I needed to feel bad about that, because again, it was just meant to be a recreational thing. So, that's the saga there. And, if that answers your question.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
There's a point here, which, skill acquisition is, the whole process is sort of a blessing and a curse, because it can sort of go on. The question is, how good is good enough? And are you always pushing to get better? Is there some level which you're happy to sort of stay where you are? And at that point, is it okay to switch to something else? Are you then a dilettante or a quitter? I think I probably had some residual guilt about not racing. I felt like I was abandoning something, but then I decided to just, go for other types of expeditions that were more about just having fun or some other purpose besides pure competition.
Got it. I think changing track, Tom, The one piece that really blew my mind was the way you described the term baby steps. Right? In my mind, I'd understood it to be taking small steps. But you go on to say it's not just that. It's babies are a lot wiser than that. They do this with a lot of thoughtfulness. And you talk about the notion of variable practice and the way they mix it up. Could you talk a little bit about this nuance behind the term baby steps and how we can apply some of those principles as we learn something new?
Sure. Yeah, I thought it would be interesting because I was writing about beginners to think about infants because as we all once were, infants are beginners in life. So, how does it look to be a being that has to, sort of be a novice at everything, except maybe, sort of breathing. I went to New York University, they have something called the Infant Action Lab. And one of the things they study quite a bit is how babies learn to move. And there's sort of a process they go through where they will first just try to sit up a little bit. Then they might start crawling, doing these various half, crawling. Then they'll try to make this move toward walking. And, it's very interesting in terms of a learning process because they, sort of violate a lot of the things you hear about. They don't really have a specific timetable in mind or a goal. When researchers have tried to figure out where babies are even walking to, they really can't identify. They seem to be walking for the sheer pleasure of walking and to sort of practice it in a sense because there's even some question as why babies learn to walk when they can really often get around pretty well by crawling. And in a sense, learning to walk provides that much more learning opportunity because you can see more of the world. You can reach other destinations. You can interact more directly with a caregiver. So I almost think there's sort of a larger hunger for learning there going on. And importantly, that we don't give babies drills in how to walk or exercises. We just sort of leave them in a room in the house and they try it on their own. And, through this process of just simply trying, and there are a lot of, speaking of 10,000 hours, I mean, it takes, 5 years or so to become a proficient walker. So there's clearly a lot of work that goes on, even though we've sort of forgotten about that. But as part of that, there's an immense failure rate. The researchers I spoke to had filmed babies, falling 30 or 40 or even up to 70 times in an hour while trying to walk. And then they would simply shrug it off and get up and start walking again. And so there's something about, and their whole practice of learning is very sort of seems very random and playful and experimental. And they're never really trying the same thing twice because that wouldn't be a good way to learn for them because walking is often not the same thing, moving around. And there's a famous Russian movement scientist named Nikolai Bernstein who called it repetition without repetition. And this means when you're trying to solve something like walking or how to juggle, you don't simply want to do the same thing all the time because that is a very brittle practice. You might find out the way to juggle three balls perfectly if they always land perfectly in your hands. But the minute there's a little bit of variation, as there usually is, if you've stuck too closely to one drill, you won't have the flexibility to try to solve that problem in a new way. So that's just, I think babies just have this, and children in general, just there's a lot we can sort of take on about their learning process that would bring us benefits. Obviously, we know how to walk, but there's many other things that we can sort of take that spirit. Another element there would be just a lack of pressure. Certainly, parents are often eager for their children to start walking as soon as possible, but babies aren't really aware of that. They're not aware of I must learn this thing, or oh, I'm falling so much, I'm terrible, I'm embarrassed. They have none of that. They simply have the freedom to learn in a very sort of fun, low pressure environment, which adults often do not have.
Fascinating. Juggling, I was particularly curious about your piece on juggling because when I was in the UK about a couple of decades back in London, mm-hmm. I remember going to a juggling show in Covent Garden in central London. And I remember mm-hmm. walking up one of the jugglers saying, I want to learn juggling. And he told me, why don't you just come to my shop in Camden Town, which is one of the neighborhoods where, you know, generally you have every other person has a piercing in some part of the body. It's sort of where,
yes,
you know, all kinds of people, interesting people hang out. And one of the early lessons that the guy gave me was, when you're juggling, just ensure you have a different background. You know, don't do it against a plain wall. You know, one day do it against the sun, one day do it against a colored wall. Then you'll get comfortable spotting the balls amidst chaos. If you sort of learn it in a pure environment against a plain white wall, one day somebody might ask you to perform in front of a crowd of 10. And you won't be able to spot the ball because you're so used to seeing it against a white background. So it's a simple tip, but now when I go back to what you just said about, you know, just mixing up things a little bit, I go back to that piece of advice.
No, yeah, it's a great point and something that I incorporated as well. And other things as well, you know, if you always began with your dominant hand, will sometimes switch up to your right hand. And you know, and what you're saying can help you, I think, push through the plateaus that do come along in trying to learn something. I mean, because the learning curve is a sort of a capricious beast. There's very rapid progress in the beginning often, but then you sort of hit this first plateau and the brain is essentially sort of run out of solutions to how to get to the next step. So I think part of a way to kickstart those solutions is like you say, to change the environment, change the things that you're throwing, change the way you're throwing them, change the speed at which you're throwing them. That's another tip I was given. Don't often throw at the same speed or the same height. Just practice solving the problem in as many different ways as you can, rather than simply coming up with this one perfect solution. Because the world is very rarely so perfect. You know, maybe a chessboard is an environment where there's no randomness or everything is transparent, but you know, most of the world is not like that.
True. And I think the other piece that, you know, I still aspire to move to five ball juggling at some point. I've done a few patterns in three and maybe a couple of patterns with four. Five is sort of my long-term aspiration. But the one thing that really I found fascinating was learning each pattern was like riding cycling afresh, right? You keep falling till you find balance. Similarly, you just keep dropping the balls in the new pattern, suddenly it clicks. So it's just that sort of the 0-1 nature of learning something I found quite intriguing, unlike some of the other pursuits, which are a little more linear.
Yeah, and what you say, you know, speaks to the idea that struggle that we're having until it clicks, you know, that struggle is the learning. And that once it clicks, well, then we're not really learning anymore. You know, it's good to sort of, you know, keep checking in with that skill every once in a while to make sure you still have it. But the moment your sort of brain isn't hurting anymore is the moment that the learning has stopped. And that's an interesting signal to perhaps, you know, move on to a new trick. I mean, there's nothing wrong with learning one trick and then doing something else. But that sort of thing we often forget about, I think, is that doing something poorly, performing something poorly, does not mean that learning is not happening. You know, that can be when the most robust learning is actually happening. I think it's we get so hung up on performance. So sometimes we'd rather stick with a safe, let's say, juggling routine that we know very well, rather than go through that whole struggle again of you know, trying it.
And in the book, we are a family where there's a, you know, each one of us plays an instrument. I play the guitar, my wife and my daughter play the piano, and my son is learning the ukulele. I was intrigued by the point you made about learning vocals versus playing an instrument. You say that there was an experiment conducted by Canada Royal Conservatory that kids that were learning vocals had higher IQ than kids learning the piano. Not to take it too literally, but I was curious about, you know, what makes that skill that much harder compared to playing an instrument.
Yes, well, this was a study by Schellenberg, and I don't think he actually really explains it. But there was a, and I don't want to overstate the difference here, but there was a slightly higher IQ performance by vocal students than keyboard students, who in turn had a higher IQ improvement than drama students. So it was part of this research, you know, looking into to musical lessons and the relationship to IQ. But I would speculate that if there were some, and the reason I brought it up in the book was that, you know, sort of getting this idea that often children are sort of encouraged away from singing because they're not good at it, perhaps, or not perceived to be good at it, or because parents might not think that it has the same benefit as one of these other things like violin or piano, which are sort of very, it's a very popular conception that they are equated with, you know, sort of academic improvement and achievement. So, yeah, it was interesting that I would speculate that what's going on with a vocal performance is interesting because you're not only having to perform a certain level of musicality in the sense of an instrument, whereas you are the instrument, worrying about pitch and tone and all those sorts of things, but you also have to master the language involved there, as well as the emotional component in trying to put a convincing performance across. So it's sort of almost a tripartite thing going on there when you're singing versus, you know, perhaps that engages a little bit more of the brain's architecture. And I'll probably get some, you know, music, you know, sort of researcher telling me I'm this is ridiculous. And this is just speculation. I'm saying, but yeah, so we'd have to look into it a little deeper, but
of course, not to take the scores literally, but I was curious about where that was coming from. I think,
but it's an interesting corrective to that idea that, you know, only the piano or, you know, that's the only academically, approved instrument or something like that.
Got it. You know, in the book, you also talk about the work of Rob Gray, you know, who directs the Perception and Action Lab at Arizona State University. And you talk about this notion of unlearning, and you speak about action slips, you know, things that we sort of do by default, especially in a high-pressure environment. I was curious about, you know, in your pursuit towards learning these five new skills, what have you learned about unlearning? You know, you spoke about adults having that cognitive component about, you know, like you spoke about language. Kids just speak while we sort of try to look at how it fits in with the paradigms we have, etc. So what have you learned about unlearning effectively, especially when we are, you know, learning something new?
Yeah, it's a great question. And first of all, I'm not, you know, unlearning is a strange word. It's not something that is completely, you know, agreed upon in the scientific world or the literature, and whether unlearning is something distinct from simply learning a new thing is sort of I mean, semantically it makes sense, but whether it's an actually different process, I think is not known. But you know, it makes me think of an experiment I did which I didn't mention too much in the book. But I was a keen cyclist, so I had heard about a guy who's a rocket scientist in Huntsville, Alabama, and he had this. Was doing this little experiment with a backwards bicycle, and what I mean by that is that when you turn the handlebars left, the bike actually steers to the right. This is something that has been used at various carnivals in countries like England or America. And usually, you know, the person will offer you $5 or something if you can do it correctly, if you can succeed at riding this thing. So people, the punters go up and say, yeah, I can do that. And of course, then they lose their money. But to me, it was just a fascinating example of this unlearning because I had had many years of knowing how to ride a bike. That was burned into my brain. I could ride no-handed. I could ride, you know, doing something else. Didn't have to think about it at all. So I was under the mistaken impression that that would give me a leg up in trying to learn this variation on a bicycle. When in fact the opposite was actually true. It was probably harder for me to learn that new thing because I had so much of this previous, you know, sort of program running on my desktop that it was actually impossible for me to do more than simply sit on the bike. The moment I tried to move just a little bit, my whole internal sense of balance was thrown off, and I was basically falling. We did this on the grass because mm-hmm. he actually knew that this would happen. So one of the points he made is that his children were actually able to learn it faster than he was, not necessarily because they're amazing geniuses, but because they've had less experience at riding a traditional bicycle. So they had less to unlearn. So, you know, at the end of the day, I don't really know that there's anything that different about unlearning it, that you sort of have to do it the hard way. I mean, my rocket scientist friend learned to ride it. It took him about 6 months, which is probably longer than it takes to learn to ride an actual bicycle. So, but you know, he just little daily bouts of practice. And I mean, there was sort of no secret beyond that. So I think, mm-hmm. but to your point, there were moments teachers would give me particular tricks to sort of help me get past things that were, you know, sort of habits in a way that for example, when I was trying to sing, I would have trouble with a certain high note. And as the high note was approaching, this sent a signal to my brain that, oh my God, there's this high note coming. I started to panic. My body tensed up. I would sort of raise my neck like a giraffe to try to reach this high sound. All of those things were tremendously counterproductive toward actually producing that note. So my teacher would have me do this little sort of, you know, kind of a corrective motion to, as the high note was approaching, to bend my knees and dip slightly down. And that just sort of, you know, for whatever reason, it worked. It made me stop thinking about the high note. I concentrated again instead on sort of dipping, going down. And counterintuitively, that actually made it easier to produce those high notes. So whether that was a form of unlearning, I'm not sure. But sometimes it's just a matter of disrupting a habit that you have, and those habits can be very hard to disrupt. But there are ways, and sometimes it just involves many months of practice. You know, I don't know if you drove while you were. Well, you're on the left side anyway, but you know, for a person going from a country that has right hand side drive to left hand side drive, it's the same idea.
No, I had this issue when I was when I first came to the US. We were going out for a team lunch when I was at McKinsey, and I remember telling them let's take my car, and I got into my car with three colleagues, and suddenly my sort of I started having a conversation with them as I took the car out. And I think my Indian driving instincts came in, and for a good 10 seconds, I was on the wrong side of the road, and my colleagues sort of were nudging me, you know, pointing to me, pointing fingers, and I wasn't really getting it. And then one of them had to forcibly, the guy sitting next to me forcibly took the wheel and moved me back to the lane. That's when I realized that, oops.
This goes back to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, it's good when learning a motor skill to not think about it. But this is a case with unlearning that actually is beneficial to think about it, because you need to override that existing behavior that is lurking within your body and actually pay some conscious attention. Whereas I would estimate over time that it gradually became instinctual. Although like Rob Gray says, there could be these action slips in a moment where you're distracted or panicked, you might revert to that old behavior. And you know, luckily you had colleagues with you in the car.
True.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. To understand the point Tom makes, all you need to do is go to YouTube and type the backwards brain bicycle. The video belongs to a channel, Smarter Every Day. I would really urge you to pause and do this now. It's a pretty cool video and profound at many levels. You know, it has a link to the point Tom makes about how some things are deeply ingrained in us and it's so hard for us to unlearn. And I've encountered this several times in my life. Let me talk about a couple of instances. This is in the context of my desire to learn touch typing. I must have been 3 or 4 years into my work, and I used to have this deep admiration for people who could type without looking at the keyboard. Especially when it shows up in movies, like the scene in Mission Impossible where Tom is trying to figure out what his job 3 1-4. I quickly figured a couple of websites that taught touch typing, and I spent 30 minutes a day taking lessons. But truth be told, I didn't make any progress whatsoever despite doing this for a few months. Then one of my colleagues looked at me and gave me a piece of advice. He said, while you're learning for 30 minutes, the remaining 10 hours of the day, you're reverting to your old behavior. And unless you really change that, you will not make any gains. And to me, that was a simple but a profound insight. But I resisted because that would mean I would slow down tremendously and that would have an impact on my deliverables. But at some stage, I decided to take the plunge and I said, this is the only way I will type, whatever the implication. And that really, really reduced my speed, maybe by 10x initially. But within a couple of weeks, my speed started picking up and slowly my speed was much faster than my earlier sort of clumsy way of typing. It showed me how ingrained some of these things were, and unless we really go all out, it's hard to root out some of these habits. The second context in which it showed up in my life was the context of my learning the guitar. Back in 2001, when I first moved to Bombay, I wanted to learn an instrument, and given I was learning from ground zero, I said, let me just pick the first guitar I find, and signed up. So I signed up for a teacher who was into Dandiya music, to be precise. But I didn't care. I was starting from Saregama, the equivalent of Do Re Mi, and I must have learned from him for about 3-4 years. But then I spent a long time after that goofing around in YouTube, learning chords through the net and playing somewhat okay. About 4 years back, I wanted to resume my guitar and signed up with a teacher. A pretty rigorous one actually. He asked me to show what I could play on the first day, and I was quite proud of the number of songs I was playing whose chords I knew. But he looked at my leg, the way I was not tapping, and noticed that I was playing and I was missing the beat in quite a few places. The first thing he said was, we need to get your feet tapping and your playing to coordinate with the foot tapping. I thought it was something very simple, a bit like the cycle experiment that Tom speaks about. But this one thing, this process took several months. As a matter of fact, it's still ongoing, it's work in progress, because my old habits relapse. It taught me how some of these things get ingrained, and unlearning something is often more painful than learning afresh, and requires a lot of dedicated effort. I've realized that for a lot of things where we are trying to move the needle, unless we are willing to embrace the value of discomfort and inefficiency, where our performance often takes a nosedive in the short term, we end up staying in a suboptimal or a mediocre place. Let's now get back to the conversation with Tom Vanderbilt.
And moving along, you speak about the Dreyfus model of learning, which has 5 steps. Novice, advanced, beginner, competent, proficient, and expert. I'm curious about how, what's your research or experience shown in terms of how we should adapt a learning approach as we move through these different points in the curve? Are there nuances that you've picked up in terms of how we should adapt our style as we move along?
Well, I mean, just to explain to listeners if they're not familiar, the Dreyfus skills, it was a group of brothers that were with the University of California and were doing research actually for the U.S. Air Force back in the 70s and came up with this model of how we move through these different stages, novice, advanced, beginner, competent, proficient, expert. And, you know, first of all, I'll say that I found elements of what they said in my own practice. I was sort of living them all the time. And I mean, one point they make, for example, is that novices really pay very close attention to rules. And I don't mean just like actual rules, like the rules of chess, but sort of, you know, tips and heuristics that are out there and very, I'll say very, very localized problems. A beginner driver, you know, tends to look at the front of the car or their hands on the wheel, when really what makes for good driving is to look as far down the road as possible to anticipate what is going to happen. But there's such an overwhelming information load going on for novices that they can only handle a certain flow at one time. So you sort of stick to these basic rules of thumb that you've been given. And so, you know, in chess, for example, the beginner is simply trying to pay attention to, how can I move the knight again? He can go sideways, or they might know simple suggestions like don't move your queen too early, don't trade pieces, of certain beginner rules that are given. And so you sort of go up the, as you go up the chain, you begin to move away from those what are called context-free rules and start to actually pay attention to the context around you. And so, you know, the driver will not simply, they're taught to, you know, obey every traffic signal, but there may come a time where a traffic signal is malfunctioning, or there's a truck parked in a stuck in an intersection and you have to go around and do something that's not in the rules. So, you know, the whole process of learning it is moving away from those rules, beginning to do your own analysis, and then eventually relying on a bit more intuition, not just rules and analysis, but sort of that gut instinct. And then finally, the last step, expert, would be just simply, I mean, just knowing something inside and out. And the game of chess, for example, I mean, a chess grandmaster can play blindfolded. They can remember a game from 2 weeks ago. They can remember the world championship game from last year, probably every move. They've so internalized that thing. The grandmaster Jonathan Rowson gave an interesting example of, definition of this. He said, a chess expert has run out of unfamiliar mistakes to make. Even if an expert makes a mistake or is about to make a mistake, they know they sort of know they are. Whereas the novice is unskilled and unaware of it. I'm not sure I had any flashes of insight in terms of how to move through these stages, or that they even really were discrete stages. I think it is more sort of a continuum, and you just. You can sort of, and sometimes you could be inhabiting both worlds. And this is a point we should probably make about learning, is that it's not often linear. And if you were trying to learn juggling, for example, you might have done 40 cycles of three ball pattern one day, and then struggled to do six or seven the next day. And so you might have been briefly inhabiting the world of the advanced beginner, and then gone back to beginner, and. Sometimes you just have to, again, change up your practice, take a break, walk away. So, I think the drive is, it's an interesting way to think about it, and is generally, sort of correct. It's maybe more sort of a descriptive tool rather than an actual, way to approach learning. Because I don't think there's a way for beginners to cheat and skip that stage. Yeah. And simply, you can't simply start as a competent surfer. You sort of have to be a beginner.
It's interesting you speak about going away and coming back again. I happened to speak to ex-world number one in chess, a gentleman called Vishwanathan Anand from India, on the podcast as well. And he said that, sometimes he would do a puzzle late at night, and he would sort of, his mind would be confused, but he would wake up with a clear mind. When he woke up, he could see the solution in his head. And his point was, we sometimes underestimate the power of the subconscious. It's back to the inner game of tennis that we spoke about. We sometimes think that we are processing these things, but actually the inner work that's happening is often a lot more powerful than the outer work that we put in consciously. So his point was, sometimes just clocking in the hours and then also taking advantage of sleep sometimes can be a great opportunity to sort of come back and fight the battle another day.
Yes, I mean, that's a fantastic point, and that is something that you can find abundant evidence for, the benefit of sleep upon the learning process, and or even napping, and not trying to cram too much practice into one session. This has sort of has come out in the learning literature over the last few decades, the idea of distributed practice and doing a little bit each day rather than these huge chunks. And when you don't have the time to sleep, there's even little tricks, thinking of chess, it's been suggested, simply closing your eyes and then opening them again and looking at the board might, a quick sort of mental refresh to give yourself, actually fresh eyes, the eyes of a beginner, perhaps trying to look at the board in a new way, rather than simply gazing more intently at it.
Wow. And changing topics, Tom, one of the other pieces I'm curious about is the feedback loop when we learn something, right? In a world where so much is available on, you know, YouTube and Coursera and Udemy and all these MOOCs, you know, there are a few skills where there is a benefit of having somebody watch us and give feedback to us real time for us to learn. What have you, in your attempt to learn these five skills, what have you learned about, you know, the limitations of online learning and the benefits of having somebody, you know, walk this journey with us? Can you talk a little bit about the role of the feedback here?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think there are some skills, some things we would want to learn that where immediate or personal feedback is much more important. There are other things that are a bit more, let's say, mechanistic or much more could be sort of picked up by simply observing. But there are things, you know, for example, let's say singing. You know, I had various forms of feedback when I was trying to learn to sing. One of these, for example, was simply an app on my phone called Perfect Pitch. And it's, you would open the app and sing a set of scales into it, and it would give you a score of 0 to 100 saying how well you had done. And I will say in the beginning, I was literally in the 50s or 60s, and it got to the point through repetition and practice where I was able to get, you know, let's say 100 fairly consistently, or the high 90s. So that's that motor skill part of singing. For those people out there who might think that it's purely an innate talent, you know, you can become a better singer purely by doing this. But that's sort of only half the picture. You know, that sort of, it showed me that I was getting better over time, but it didn't exactly show me why. And that's where the coach I was working with, vocal instructor, came in and you know, actually, while I was singing, really, really intently listening to me and intently watching my whole set of vocal muscles work and give me very precise corrections at the moment. And it was very sort of a almost intimate and physical process too, because the whole body is involved, and to, you know, correct me on my posture and all sorts of things that a person would not necessarily be aware of themselves. Just you know, working at home or trying to follow along online. So I think there are the more complex skills, you know, just have that, almost need that, you know, sort of constant monitoring. And you know, there's some discussion in the literature whether positive feedback is more important than negative. And I think positive feedback is probably more important, because there are something like singing, and there are more ways to go wrong than there are to go right. So you should really emphasize the times when the person has gotten it right, because they are probably aware, number one, that they've gotten it wrong. Mm. And then there's the motivational component. It just, you know, it simply makes the learner feel better to hear that they're doing well. Which is not to say it needs to be sugar-coated. I mean, you know, you should be given, it needs to have a corrective aspect. So you don't want to have a coach who's simply telling you everything's great all the time. That doesn't really work either. But it's a very important part of it. And the last thing I'll say is just the frequency of feedback can be really helpful. One of the problems with surfing is that the feedback loops can be very long. What I mean is that sometimes when you go to the ocean, you might only, during the course of an hour of surfing, catch 6 or 7 waves, or try to catch 6 or 7 waves because of, you know, what the ocean is doing that day. And an instructor pointed out to me, you know, can you imagine trying to learn the guitar if you could only strum 6 or 7 times an hour? I mean, that's just it's not the most efficient way to learn. So, you know, sometimes the feedback loops are not, you know, tight enough. It's hard to learn from each. You simply don't get as much practice or as much chance to be observed, as much chance to learn from your mistakes when there are fewer opportunities to actually do the thing. So that's just another aspect that can come into it.
And, you know, I'm reminded of, you know, let's say maybe a forward in soccer. You know, you get the ball once in maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes from the defenders to the midfield to the forward, and you need to sort of, you need to score. And of course, in practice, you probably simulate those situations hundreds and thousands of times. But in the, if you really look at match practice, you know, it's just these occasional passes that come to you and you need to sort of score. I can imagine training for, you know, match readiness, especially if you're sort of in some of these positions, can be tricky.
Yeah, it's a very good point, which I hadn't thought about. But soccer was not one of my skills, so I don't say anything else about that. But I did play soccer, but I was defense. So
Tom, moving along, you speak about your experiences with learning drawing and appreciating the art of observing what is without being biased by patterns or objects that we look for. You know, what can we learn about the way artists see the world in the context of being fully present, you know, and just focus on what is rather than preset patterns that our mind might gravitate towards?
Yeah, it's a very good point. And, you know, going into drawing was something I had wanted to pick up for a long time. I dabbled just a tiny bit. Of course, as a child, like many children, I had done a fair bit of drawing and sort of walked away from it. So when I tried to return to it at age my mid-40s, of course, the first drawing I produced was essentially, you know, a frozen in amber, you know, time capsule of the last drawing I had worked on as a child. So my drawing had not progressed at all. But that's just one point I want to make. But the thing, you know, going into drawing, I sort of, in my mind, I thought the whole process was more mystical and more about sort of holding the pencil a certain way and really training your arm to do this certain thing. And when really the whole process, as I began to learn it, was simply about looking at the world in a new way. And what happens is I took this course based on a very famous book called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain by a woman named Betty Edwards. And this is a very famous book that has probably taught more people how to draw in the world than anything. So I took a 1-week seminar here, and the first thing you're asked to do is draw a self-portrait. I mean, within the first 10 minutes, you're asked to draw a self-portrait. Mm-hmm. This is terrifying because I haven't drawn something in a long time. And the results were pretty poor, as you might imagine. But more than just poor, you know, it just didn't look like me, and it didn't really look like a human. And the problem was is that, you know, we sort of, when we try to reproduce a human face on paper, we bring in, as you mentioned, this set of symbols. Like we think we know what eyes look like. We think we know what a mouth looks like. We think we know where the eyes sit in relation to the forehead or the jaw. All these things are based on some sort of internal cognitive calculus that we make that turn out to be wrong when tried to put in a two-dimensional form on paper. So the whole, you know, what drawing really was for me was sort of breaking down those preconceptions and learning to look at what was actually out in front of me in the world. So for example, when we were asked to draw a chair, I had this, for lack of a better word, sense of chairness in my head, the way I thought a chair looked. And when the teacher came over, he was sort of saying, well, your proportions look a bit wrong here. And to my mind, it looked perfect, like the perfect platonic chair, this ideal chair. But when I measured the chair I was trying to draw, I had gotten it completely wrong. And it was just such a striking moment where how could my own senses fool me to such a, there've been a lot of interesting books about cognitive biases and illusions in psychology, but here it was, you know, sort of brought very close to home to me it was really just sort of a slow process of unpacking these conceptions, trying to get them out of your head and look at the world in a new sort of granularity, looking, you know, for the texture of things, not the category of objects that they belong to. And it was, and by the end of the week, we were asked to make another self-portrait. And the entire class had such an amazing improvement in this regard. It was quite striking to me. We learned quite a bit, and a lot of it didn't really have to do with moving our pencil in any special way. It was just, again, trying to just look at the world in a new way. So I'm not sure what the larger metaphor here is. I mean, I think there's a idea that, you know, we live much of our lives habitually. There's a lot of stuff the brain screens out as we move around in the world because we're trying to, you know, conserve our resources or simply get through the world. But, you know, stopping to take time to look at the way things really are, you know, can be a very instructive exercise, I think. And I'll just say in terms of focus and flow and elements like that, there's nothing I've done in the last decades that I can think of that compares to drawing in this regard, that I would lose track of time and 4 or 5 hours would pass. And I would still be sort of deep into this drawing, which I just found in this age of endless distraction and short attention spans, that I found that a very powerful and sort of cleansing exercise.
And what about, and I'm curious, I'm pretty hopeless when it comes to drawing, but I'm curious, what about learning drawing or doing the drawing makes it, makes you lose track of time? Is there anything about it which leads to this kind of a phenomenon?
I would say, I mean, just that sense of deep concentration really, you know, once you start to look at the way things really are, and I don't want to sound too grandiose here, but I mean, I was looking in the corners of rooms trying to depict a shadow and then suddenly realizing the shadow itself had 4 or 5 other shadows. And so you begin thinking it's going to be a very short process, but the longer you look, the more there is to see. And that, I think, is where you begin to lose track of time because you're simply, you know, unlocking all these doors and plunging more deeply. And then just, again, being in this state of just perfect flow where you're completely intent on capturing this moment that sort of a different time scale takes over. And I don't think there are many opportunities. You know, there are certain other activities, I'm sure, where these certain states like that can be reached. To me, not having done meditation, I sort of imagined it was what meditation might feel like when practiced at its sort of highest, you know, capabilities. But it was meditation for me with a purpose, where I had something to, I had a document of that moment that I could sort of leave the room with, which was also very satisfying.
Got it. You also say that we live in a frictionless age where the emphasis is on speed learning and the process is often obscured by results. You know, what does that mean in terms of how we should approach learning, Tom? Have you, you know, with everything available on YouTube, has it made it harder for us to embrace high friction learning? What have you observed?
I think so. I mean, there's a certain messaging out there that, you know, you don't have to look very far online to find promises of, you know, learn to speak like a native in 6 months or something, you know, which is almost quite impossible. But, you know, I think like everything, we want something to be done quickly. And there certainly are realms where, you know, it is desirable and even possible to learn things more quickly. And there's no reason to artificially delay it. But in my process, because I didn't really have discrete goals, you know, I wasn't trying to simply learn, you know, let's say a new computer system or something. These were things that were open-ended. So I quite purposely didn't really set time or achievement goals. I just wanted to sort of see how far I could get and do a very sort of slow, purposeful learning where I was really paying attention to the whole process, including mistakes and not simply, you know, trying to rush to the next thing, but kind of savoring those mistakes and taking the time to understand them. So, you know, this sort of approach isn't going to work for everyone or in every you know, condition. But I would urge people to not let the notion of time or goals interfere too much. I use sort of compare it to the process of tourism versus travel. And, you know, you can take a package tour and go somewhere and see an entire city in 48 hours. and everything is sort of taken care of for you and you don't have to think much and you just sort of consume everything. Or you could take, you know, a much longer trip that you've arranged yourself. You have you might have a loose itinerary, but you mostly are just exploring and seeing what paths you might go down. Mm-hmm. And that was my sort of process in this. And the French, you know, the root of the word travel is travail, from the French, which means pain. So there's, you know, there's a certain amount of struggle that that might be involved here, but I think it's very rewarding struggle. And, you know, there's nothing, I don't want to say there's anything wrong with taking a package tour, but, you know, that's just a certain thing. And that is one way to consume an experience. And I would argue, though, that the second way might be more ultimately fulfilling. And I think we can kind of apply that notion to learning.
Well, that's a wonderful parallel. Just as we wrap up, Tom, you know, I was curious about breadth versus depth, you know, given paucity of time, you know, what's your take on, you know, embarking on new things versus maybe going up the mastery curve on a few things? What have you learned through this phase?
Yeah, man, I was sort of going back to, in trying to achieve this sense of beginner's mind, as the Buddhists call it, you know, sort of seeing the world like a child does. I sort of went back to that idea that children are not learning one thing. They're not trying to achieve mastery in anything, that they were learning many things at once. And it was a very sort of noisy environment, and, you know, they might not make equal progress and all these things. So that was sort of my intention. And there's obviously nothing wrong with expertise and mastery. And I, you know, there's certain things I am trying to move toward that in my own life, but it can be an all-consuming process or an exhausting process. And I think even a master in something takes a certain pleasure or can get a benefit from dabbling in something else, which might provide, you know, a fresh perspective, a new energy to their own mastery. There's a great study that I refer to a lot that was also mentioned in a great book by David Epstein called Range, which is about the benefits of being a generalist in an increasingly specialized world. But he's talking about Nobel Prize scientists. The scientists who had won the Nobel were much more likely statistically to have participated in amateur activities, performing arts, you know, magic tricks, things like this, than non-Nobel Prize winners. And I thought this was very interesting because, you know, it's not necessarily that there's a one-on-one relationship between doing this side thing and improving your scientific career, but, you know, maybe it just gave those scientists a new way of thinking about their work, some unexpected you know, perspective. Perhaps just brought them joy that made them work in a different way in their own life. So I think there's there can just be this, even in the, once you've achieved mastery, this benefit to being unafraid to step away from that mastery and be a beginner in something as clumsy and embarrassing as it can be, because that, again, to get back to the point, that is when you're learning. When you're a beginner, if you're a master, you've basically already learned it. So you're sort of continuing on in your practice. So so that was my, I think each person probably has their own internal compass of what they, how they would like to do something or what they would want. But I would urge people not to be afraid of that, of the word, you know, dilettante has a negative reputation these days. But I make the point that it goes back to this group of 18th century English people who were in love with, you know, the art and culture of the continent and traveled to places like Italy and just soaked up the music and the language and the food and the art and the history. And they weren't specialists. They weren't professionals. They were simply enthusiasts, but they were, you know, enthusiasts with a real passion. And because dilettante means to delight in. So they took delight in these things.
Absolutely.
And that was the spirit I was going in with.
Lovely. So, Tom, as we wrap up, the final question, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. You know, given the journey you've been through, and the perspectives you have. What's your take on playing to fullest potential?
Well, you know, I think sometimes we might not even know what our potential is. I mean, we might have an idea in our head, but until we actually go down certain paths, we may have that wrong idea. I mean, for example, you know, in this book, I took up singing and then I joined a choir, and which ended up becoming a very important part of my life. And 3 years prior, I not only was not in a choir, I had expressed zero desire to be in a choir. No one I know had ever heard me talk about wanting to be in a choir. This was something that was not important to me at all. I had deemed not to be important. But the mere process of trying to learn this thing had opened these sorts of doors, as I describe it, into these other worlds, which then brought interesting new relationships, just interesting ways of engaging with the world. It changed the way I listened to music. So I think, you know, the psychologist Daniel Gilbert at Harvard talks about something called the end of history illusion, where people often think that they, as he describes it, they think they've reached this watershed moment where they are the person they are going to be. And, if you think about this, you know, from your own experience, it probably doesn't make sense, because 10 years ago, you were probably a different sort of person. You were probably in a different place, doing a different version of your job or a different job entirely. Mm. And you did evolve in 10 years. So why wouldn't we think we would evolve in the next 10 years? And so rather than think of ourselves as having this fixed identity, or that we're already at our full potential or working toward our full potential, you know, just to be open-minded about the idea that that potential may be something we're not aware of or may come from an unexpected direction. And to, when you see those closed doors, to actually, you know, push one of them open and see where it leads, even though it might be, again, awkward in the beginning.
Lovely. Tom, it's been wonderful having you at the podcast. Thank you so much for your time and your insights.
Thank you, Deepak.
Thank you for listening. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. A couple of messages before we wrap up. If you find the podcast purposeful, do take a moment and contribute to Antarang Foundation. I work closely with them and can vouch for their impact with young adults who come from challenging backgrounds. While we are battling the health crisis, we cannot afford to ignore the issue of solving for livelihoods in our battle to save lives. The second COVID wave has further worsened the employment crisis in India, and supporting an organization like Antarang can mean a lot in these challenging times. You can get more details at the paid forward section at playtopotential.com. Do also rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you consume the content. It might seem like a repetitive ask, but trust me, it makes a big difference in people discovering the podcast amidst a lot of noise out there, given the boom in the podcast supply in India in the last few months. It also helps us attract good quality speakers, because they often look for these metrics. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. To receive a bite-sized nugget every 3-4 days from the podcast archives, do send a WhatsApp message to +91 85914 52129 stating interested. Please do add this number to the contacts as well, which will make it easy for us to share this content with you. Thank you, and hope to have you tune into one of the subsequent conversations of the podcast. Bye now.